Where's everybody at?
Here, Mr. President. Mr. President, your Judiciary Committee number one is ready to vote.
I don't think we have a quorum, do we, Ellen? Chief Clerk, please call the roll.
Roll call for Wednesday, January 11th. Agar.
Here.
Anderson.
Here.
Anselmi Dalton.
Here.
Baldwin.
Here.
Barnard.
Here.
Boner.
Here.
Bouchard.
Here.
Burns.
Excused.
Case.
Present.
Christensen.
Here.
Coe.
Here.
Dockstetter.
Excused.
Driscoll.
Excused.
Ellis.
Here.
Emmerich.
Here.
Hastert.
Excused.
Hicks.
Here.
Kinski.
Here.
Landon.
Excused.
Meyer.
Here.
Moniz.
Here.
Nethercott.
Here.
Pappas.
Here.
Perkins.
Excused.
Peterson.
Here.
Rothfuss.
Here.
Scott.
Here.
Von Fladern.
Here.
Wasserberger.
Here.
President Bebout.
Here.
24 present, 6 excused.
Father Conklin, would you give us a prayer, please?
Let's pray. Lord God, all the formalities and the ceremonies General session have now been completed, and now it's time to settle into the routine of looking after the business of the people of the great state. Pour forth, therefore, O Lord, your grace and divine assistance upon us as we focus upon our task of governance and proceed with the work of legislating. Help us be graced with knowledge and insight, to listen with open hearts to the thoughts of others, to seek understanding with one another, to be patient with process, and to be diligent in our work. The great state faces significant challenges, but with your Holy Spirit as our guide, your creative inspiration will allow us to address the important issues before us so that we can meet the needs of the people of Wyoming. With this and all things, we ask in your name.
Amen.
Join me in the pledge. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Play ball.
Play ball. Will the reading clerk please read the Journal Committee report?
Mr. President, your Journal Committee reports that the Journal...
Oh, just a second. Excuse me. Representative Wasserberger, would you like privilege of the floor?
Make him a senator.
Senator. I wonder if you're paying attention, Senator Wasserberger, and you are. Just a second. Okay, moving right along.
I mean, Mr. President, no, I have not. I was just standing here. No reason to recognize me.
Okay. Okay, back to business of the day. Will the reading clerk please read the Journal Committee report?
Mr. President, your Journal Committee reports that the Journal of January 10, 2017 has been read and recommends that it be approved. Senator Bouchard, Chairman.
Any objections? Being none, the report is adopted. Our doctor of the day is Dr. Larry Kirvin. Larry, welcome. Great to see you. Thank you for being here. Dr. Kirvin has assured me that he understands that the Senate works really hard, harder than other people in this Capitol. He's going to take great care of us. Messages from the House.
Messages from the House of Representatives, Wyoming State Legislature. January 10, 2016, message number one. Mr. President, the House of Representatives appointed the following employees for the 2017 General Session of the 64th Legislature. They are as follows. Chief Clerk Wendy Harding, dispensing with the reading, signed Wendy Harding, House Chief Clerk. January 10, 2017, message number 2. Mr. President, this is to inform you that the House has adopted the permanent and joint rules of the 63rd Wyoming State Legislature Budget and General Session as the temporary rules of the 64th Wyoming State Legislature General Session. Signed, Wendy Harding, House Chief Clerk. January 10, 2017, message number 3. Mr. President, the House of Representatives of the 64th Wyoming State Legislature General Session has been called to order by Speaker Steve Harshman and is ready to receive any communications that you may desire to submit. Signed, Wendy Harding, House Chief Clerk.
I forgot to talk a little bit about today in Wyoming history, but it wasn't a good day, so maybe it was appropriate. Anyway, in 1970, fire destroys two downtown blocks in Cheyenne. Okay, we're at that business introduction, reading and reference of bills. First Senate file for our consideration is Senate File 59. The reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 59, Government Ethics, Clerks of the District Courts, sponsored by Senator Driscoll.
Senate File 59 will be assigned to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Senate File 65, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 65, Sexual Assault, Position of Authority, sponsored by Senator Boner.
Senate File 65 will be referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Senate File 41, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 41, Enterprise Technology Services Amendments, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee.
Senate File 41 will be referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Senate File 47, reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 47, State Institution Revenue Accounts, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee.
Senate File 47 will be referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Senate File 49.
Senate File 49, Investment Funds Committee, sponsored by the CAP Financing Committee.
Senate File 49 will be referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Senate File 50, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 50, Civics Educational Programs, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee.
Senate File 50 will be referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Senate File 51, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 51, Approval of Water Funds Transfer, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee.
Senate File 51 will be assigned to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Senate File 52, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 52, Fund Balance Definition, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee.
Senate File 52 will be referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Senate File 9, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 9, Certification of Cases to State Board of Equalization, sponsored by the Revenue Committee.
Senate File 9 will be referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Senate File 10, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 10, County Boards of Equalization, sponsored by the Revenue Committee.
Senate File 10 will be referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Senate File 11, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 11, License Revocation Process, sponsored by the Revenue Committee.
Senate File 11 will be referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Senate File 22, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 22, Notice of Valuation Change Reporting, sponsored by the Revenue Committee.
Senate File 22 will be referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Senate File 23, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 23, Fuel Tax Appeals, sponsored by the Revenue Committee.
Senate File 23 will be referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Senate File 70, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 70, Manufacturing Machinery Exemption Sunset Date, sponsored by Senator Kinski.
Senate File 70 will be referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Senate File 48, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 48, Farm Loan Program Amendments, sponsored by Senator Emmerich.
Senate File 48 will be referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. Senate File 24, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 24, Film Industry Financial Incentive Program, sponsored by the Travel Committee.
Fifi, Senate File 24 will be referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. Senate File 25, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 25, Wildlife Location and Research Information, Confidentiality, sponsored by the Travel Committee.
Senate 25 will be referred to Committee Number 6, Travel and Rec. Senate File 26, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 26, Game and Fish Licenses, Confidentiality, sponsored by the Travel Committee.
Senate File 26 will be referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. Senate File 27, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 27, State Archives Amendments, sponsored by the Travel Committee.
Senate File 27 will be referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. Senate File 60, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 60, Antelope Hunts, Complementary Licenses, sponsored by Senator Anderson.
Senate File 60 will be referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. Senate Joint Resolution 1, will the reading clerk please read the Senate Joint Resolution?
Senate Joint Resolution Number 1, Right of Privacy and Right to Know, sponsored by the Corporations Committee.
Senate Joint Resolution Number 1 will refer to Committee Number 7, Corporations. Senate File 44, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 44, Speech Pathology and Audiology, sponsored by the Corporations Committee.
Senate File 44 will be referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. Senate File 45, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 45, Liquor Dispensing Rooms, sponsored by the Corporations Committee.
Senate File 45 will be referred to Committee Number 7, Cooperations. Senate File 46, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 46, Appeals by County Assessor, sponsored by Senator Case.
Senate File 46, I'm having trouble saying corporations. There's so many bills going over there. Senate File 46 will be referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. Senate File 61, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 61, County Attorney's Salaries, sponsored by Senator Christensen.
Senate File 61 will be referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. Senate File Number 19, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 19, Snowplow Lights, sponsored by Senator Emmerich.
Senate File 19 will be referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. Senate File 38, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 38, Veteran License Plate Stickers Repeal, sponsored by the Transportation Committee.
Senate File 38 will be referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. Senate File 55, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 55, Anti-Discrimination Military Spouses, sponsored by the Transportation Committee.
Senate File 55 will be referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. Senate File 57, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 57, Motor Vehicle Franchises Exception, sponsored by Senator Case.
Senate File 57 will be referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. Senate File 64, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 64, Accident Report Confidentiality, sponsored by Senator Von Flatern.
Senate File 64 will be referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. Senate Joint Resolution 2, will the reading clerk please read the Senate Joint Resolution 2?
Senate Joint Resolution 2, Federal Land, Wind, and Solar Energy Revenue, State Share, sponsored by Senator Driscoll.
Senate Joint Resolution Number 2 will be referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals. Senate File 68, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 68, Net Metering Generation Capacity, sponsored by Senator Burns.
Senate File 68 will be referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals. Senate File 21, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 21, Death Certificates, sponsored by Senator Baldwin.
Senate File 21 will be referred to Committee Number 10, Labor. Senate File 66, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 66, Title 25, Payment Obligations, Federal Entities, sponsored by the Labor Committee.
Senate File 66 will be referred to Committee Number 10, Labor. Senate File 67. Will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 67, CHIP Program Amendments, sponsored by the Labor Committee.
Senate File 67 will be referred to Committee Number 10, Labor. Senate File 69, will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 69, Small Employer Health Reinsurance Program Amendments, sponsored by the Labor Committee.
Senate File 69 will be referred to Committee Number 10, Labor. Any others? That's it for now. Reports from standing committees.
January 11, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number one, to whom was referred Senate File 30, Jail Placement Coordination, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amendment amended. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Kinski, and Nethercott. Excused, Senator Hicks. January 11, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number one, to whom was referred Senate File 33, Computer Extortion, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senator Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Kinski, and Nethercott. Excused, Senator Hicks. January 11, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number five, to whom was referred Senate File 3, Select Water Committee Review of Projects, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Emmerich, Hicks, Meyer, Moniz. No, Senator Barnard. Senator Hicks, Chairman. January 11, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number one, to whom was referred Senate File 42, Opiate Overdose Emergency Treatment, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Kinski, and Nethercott. Excused, Senator Hicks. Senator Christensen, Chairman. January 11, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number one, to whom was referred Senate File 31, Genetic Information Privacy, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senator Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Kinski, and Nethercott. Excused, Senator Hicks. Senator Christensen, Chairman. January 11, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number four, to whom was referred Senate File 20, Student Digital Information Privacy, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Coe, Ellis, Pappas, and Rothfuss. No, Senator Wasserberger. Senator Coe, Chairman. January 11, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number four, to whom was referred Senate File 35, Virtual Education, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Coe, Ellis, Pappas, and Wasserberger. Excused, Senator Rothfuss. Senator Coe, Chairman. January 11, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number five, to whom was referred Senate File 8, Transfer of Water Funds, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Barnard, Emmerich, Hicks, Meyer, and Moniz. Senator Hicks, Chairman.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. President, Judiciary Committee number one, I'd like to refer Senate File 42, Opiate Overdose Emergency Treatment, to Appropriations. There is an appropriation.
Okay, so noted. With that business of consideration of bills on general file, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, you've heard the, are you ready for a motion?
Yes, I am, Mr. President. I move that the Senate resolve itself a committee of the whole.
You heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. Senator Hastert.
Do you need your sheet?
We'll get it when it comes up. We'll just.
Chairman's already screwing up.
Oh, I'm on.
Yeah. I know. There we go.
I got Drew off now. The Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 3. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 3, Select Water Committee Review of Projects, sponsored by the Agriculture Committee. Was referred to Committee Number 5, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Emmerich, Hicks, Meyer, and Moniz. No, Senator Barnard. Senator Hicks, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Hicks?
Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate File Number 3, Select Water Committee Review of Projects, and ask for Senator Myers to give an explanation of the bill.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Von Flanagan.
Thank you. I just want to get it straight for everybody here that the motion is when the Committee of the Whole rises. And so as long as everybody knows that, we're good to go.
Thank you, Senator Von Flanagan. And it is when the Committee of the Whole rises to report. Okay, Senator Meyer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, there was a standing committee amendment number 1. I'd ask the reading clerk read that amendment in at this time.
Reading clerk, read the amendment.
Senate File 3, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 3.
Mr. Chairman, I would explain this amendment and move it because essentially that is the bill because we took the new language that was in the bill and replaced it with the new language in the amendment. And so I would move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment, and let me explain that. In explaining it, I will explain the bill. The bill came from the Select Water Committee, went over to the Joint Interim Ag Committee because the Select Water Committee doesn't sponsor bills, but it was generated out of the Select Water Committee. The reason for the bill was a situation where the Select Water Committee wanted to opine about some funds that came in from an electrical generation account on the Colorado River and how those funds were spent. And the Water Development Commission basically said, hey, these aren't state funds. We don't have to listen to you. So please sit down and let us do our job. And we kind of took aback at that a little bit, some of the Select Water Committee members, and thought that because they were actually spending funds in which on a different set of projects that were already appropriated for during the appropriation process that were came about from the Game and Fish, that maybe we ought to be able to at least opine and offer our recommendations. And so what this language does is essentially say that in the duties of the Select Water Committee that they review the budgets of all projects and make recommendations. And so the new language would be regardless of funding sources. And so if it's federal funds and it's used, spent on projects within the state of Wyoming, the Select Water Committee wants to be able to review those projects and make recommendations. And that's the reason for the bill. These meetings between Select Water and the Water Development Commission are concurrent. We're all in the same room at the same table. And because we have a seat at the table, we just want to be able to be listened to. So that's the reason for the bill, the meaning for the bill, language in the bill. Ask for the favorable consideration of the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Question being called. You've heard the question for Senator Meyer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so. No, it does on amendment. These all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 3, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Amendment passes. We're back on the bill. Any further discussion on the bill?
Question on the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion on the bill? Okay, so now, are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Hicks's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 3, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 3 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 8. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 8, Transfer of Water Funds, an act relating to water, sponsored by the Select Water Committee, was referred to Committee Number 5, which respectfully reports a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Barnard, Emmerich, Hicks, Meyer, and Moniz, Senator Hicks, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Hicks?
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I ask for a favorable consideration for Senate File 8, transfer of water funds. I would ask for the Senator Myers to give an explanation of the bill.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, what this does is go into a statute that we have on the books, and the statute at this point in time has different accounts for different reservoirs, and in those accounts, Buffalo Bill is one of them that a lot of you know about, is that you have monies for operations and maintenance. And the two additions that we have in this are the Glendale Reservoir and the Pathfinder Reservoir. In the Glendale and the Pathfinder Reservoir, the Water Development Commission advanced funds for the operation and maintenance of, and in certain circumstances, extraordinary circumstances, money for those to Glendale and to Pathfinder. In Glendale, the case, it was account number one, the planning account, and in Pathfinders, it was account number two. What this does is allow, as has been done with the other reservoirs, when there's excess funds, for those funds to be transferred back to those, original accounts. And so that's what it does. Glendale is the paragraph, the addition of M in line four. And Pathfinder is the addition of K for account number two in line seven. And essentially that's what it does is allow those transfer back by the Water Development Commission back to their original accounts. And I would stand for any questions.
Any further discussion on Senate File 8, Mr. President?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. When we're talking about the Pathfinder modification account and the fiscal profile, it says proposal for a minimum of $5 million of the Pathfinder account was presented to the WWDC. Does that mean that's the amount of money that you don't think you'll be needing that would be available? And if that's the amount of money that would be available, is that coming in another bill later to put into that account so we might appropriate? Just wondering because some of those things come up after the fact and if there has some discussion about that.
Senator Meyer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, these transfers and stuff will be seen in the different omnibus bills, the planning bill or the construction bill, depending on which account that they go into. Planning is one. I think account number two isn't dam construction, but it's a rehabilitation. But in those different accounts, when the main bills come through, you'll see those transfers, and if it's something that the body wants to say, no, wait a second, we want to stop that transfer that the Water Development Commission suggested, then those transfers would stop, and we'd have to do a rebalancing of the priorities of the projects that had been funded off of the transfers. So that's how the legislature gets in and is able to, I guess, double check what the works of the Select Water and what the Water Development Commission does is through the omnibus bills.
Further discussion, Mr. President.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I understand that, and that's the way it should be. But I want to. What the real question is: there $5 million available in a Pathfinder modification account that you're thinking about having access to out of the $8.8 million that's there.
Senator Meyer.
Dear Mr. Chairman, the way I read it, there's $8.8 million there in Pathfinder, but there's other obligations that of $1.2 and $6 million. And what I think what you'll actually see is that there isn't going to be a transfer out of the Pathfinder account because of the Platte River Recovery Implementation Program. There's a possibility of $6 million being out of that. So if you have $6 million and $1.2 million, we know that things that may be coming forward are $7.2 million, and there's $8.8 million in there. And so they're getting pretty thin right now as far as what can be used out of that account. So I'm not sure what's in the omnibus bill. I could track that in and tell you, and we'll have that up next week. But I don't think there's going to be anything coming out of that. The last one says it's unknown at this time and would depend on future obligations against the Pathfinder account and the deliberation of the Wyoming Water Development Commission. So, you know, it doesn't specifically say what's coming out of there, but we know that we want to look at the excess funds that might be there. And so I think Harry's going to took some out, but I can't tell you exactly what was on that spreadsheet the last time I saw it in front of Select Water. So, you know, I can get that for you, Eli, to see what they're actually saying, but I don't think they're trying to cut it clear down to $5
million. Mr. President. Question, Mr. Chairman. You know, I think in the Platte or in the Pathfinder Dam, we set up the situation where I believe 20,000 acre-feet of water was with the Casper. This in no way, shape, or form affects any of that, correct?
Senator Meyer.
No, Mr. Chairman, that there's no effect as that. We started with 50,000, 20 was the Casper. Some went through the Platte River Recovery. Some is has multiple uses to it, municipal plus mitigating water in the triangle for the North Platte Recovery. So there's multiple uses for the Pathfinder water. But this doesn't talk about water. This just talks about excess funds that were put into the original projects, you know, for basically for your O&M, and if there's any extraordinary things that might occur. So there were some extraordinary things, like the mitigation would be an extraordinary one because money is taken out of that, the purchase water from Cheyenne and the Transbasin diversion, so water can be put back into the account for mitigation in the North Platte decree with compact with Nebraska. So, you know, there's different things the money is used for that could be extraordinary, like in a drought situation. And so we want to make sure that those there's enough funds to handle those extraordinary things. But then again, in a tight budget constraints, you know, we want to be able to make sure that there's different coffee cans available. You know, if we need planning or we need rehabilitation, and there's always other projects, you know, left on the list that aren't funded that go through the process. And so this is just a way to open up these two coffee cans to future use if it's deemed necessary and if it's determined there's excess funds. But it still has a legislative overview, so we can still claw back if we absolutely have to.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just another question in that regard. So you said this, there's still legislative oversight. I heard that. And what I want to do is, ultimately, as I understand the bill, and in looking at the paragraph 2 of the fiscal note, Mr. Chairman, says the bill would extend the authority of the Water Development Commission to transfer excess funds from Pathfinder Modification Count Water Development Counts 1 and 2, and then goes through a further explanation. So as we talk about that, if they transfer that out, if we could have a little more explanation, if we could, from the good senator from Platte County, about that legislative oversight. Is that additional? Is that subject to the interim appropriation, or does that go when we see it after the fact, or what's the nature of the legislative oversight as we watch these accounts being we've extended the authority, it says, to transfer those funds. And I just want to know, what is the legislative oversight with respect to the transfer and then subsequent use of those funds?
Senator Meyer.
Yeah, Right now, I believe it's just through the omnibus bills, but I think there was another piece of legislation out there that would run basically another double check through the Appropriations Committee on the water bills. You know, if you guys wanted to take a look at the water bills too, Select Water looks at them, the Water Development Commission looks at them, and Ag looks at them. But I think there might be a bill out there to say appropriations gets a bite at that apple. I'll look at them too. I'm not going to talk about that bill right now. I think when it comes up, you know, you guys can look at it. But it does have the full oversight as far as the legislative process, as far as it does come to the floor, and everybody gets to look at, you know, the main budgets on each one of the counts, 1, 2, and 3. And, you know, where all that money is spent and which projects are funded and which projects aren't funded and how they're funded. So the whole floor gets to take a look at all of those. I think we're going to have a new chairman that's going to walk us around the state of Wyoming and tell you exactly where all those are spent and how they're spent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question for the sponsor. When I read M in the statutes, because you do say that you'll transfer funds, and I do believe that it says, and it includes M, Section M as in Mike, but Section M says you'll transfer it to Glendo. I mean, that only will, so it seems to be conflicting with M, because in the statutes, M says it will be transferred into the Glendo Reserve Fund, I think. Is what I read. Glendo Reserve Account, Reservoir Account, Reserve Account. So I'm just curious if somehow you got, you shouldn't have had him or notwithstanding him or something of that nature.
Senator Meyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd have to look at the talk with LSO, and this is the drafting that came out of the Water Development Office. And M was associated with Glendo and in that other statute, and this was part of the statute that was talking about excess funds, and I think they used M for consistency to have them both being the same, but I can get some clarification on that, Mr. Chairman, and get with the Vice President and make sure that we're satisfied with the drafting. If not, we'll ask LSO to make sure it's clear.
Any further discussion? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Hicks's motion, when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 8. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 8 has passed Committee of the Whole. And just one quick note. There was a, I should have caught it when it was being said, but there was a point when a formal name was used instead of a title, and let's make sure we keep it to the titles there. All right, next bill for our consideration is Senate File 33. Will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 33, Computer Extortion, an act relating to offenses against computer property, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee. Was referred to Committee Number 1, which returned a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Kinski, and Nethercott. Excused, Senator Hicks. Senator Christensen, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Mr. Chairman, I move introduction of Senate File 33, Computer Extortion, and...
Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report.
There we've got it. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 33 and ask for your favorable consideration. Senator Rothfuss will present the bill, and there is a standing committee amendment.
Do you want that read in now?
Please.
Senate File 33, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 15.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 33, Computer Extortion, is being sponsored by the Judiciary Committee, but it's a product of the interim work of the Digital Information Privacy Task Force. It creates a new crime and penalty within Article 5, Computer Crimes of Title 6, Chapter 3, and the computer extortion concept actually exists in two separate components already in statute. You technically have a computer trespass violation available, which can be a misdemeanor or a felony. You also have an extortion statute, which could be prosecuted. We were asked as the Digital Information Privacy Task Force to consider putting that together into one crime that addresses specifically a circumstance that is very common currently of ransomware or computer extortion. And, Mr. Chairman, what happens is you have a hacker, typically it's even autonomous, nobody knows it's happening, that's breaking into a computer. It finds a computer that might be public resources, and it encrypts the data that's being stored on that computer. So it doesn't delete it, it doesn't get rid of it, but it encrypts it. So it's still there on that source computer. And then when the user comes along and tries to access that precious data, there's a little pop-up that says, you know, congratulations, you've been infected with this horrible ransomware, and if you want your data unencrypted, if you want the key to that data, you will have to pay a certain number of Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency to such and such an account. So it's an extortion system that is currently rampant. There was a recent report of 25,000 servers that were infected just a couple of weeks ago. So it is a real problem. It's a problem in Wyoming. We've had instances of this. We heard in testimony that some counties have been affected, some public resources have been locked out. And currently, Mr. Chairman, the only real recourse is to pay and get your key and decrypt the valuable information unless you have some type of backup. So this legislation would explicitly create a new statute addressing that, and a new crime addressing that. We heard testimony that there are instances in the state of Wyoming. Most of these occur from other countries and from remote hacking locations, but we did hear instances that it takes place in Wyoming and that there would be potentially prosecutable offenses under this were it in place. So looking at the legislation, bottom of page one, moving on to page two, we get the definition of what computer extortion means. And a person is guilty if they knowingly, without authorization, introduce or direct the introduction of malware onto a computer system, a computer network, etc., that requires payment to repair or remove that type of damage. I'll get to the amendment after I explain the entire bill, but that's where the amendment is going to be located. B indicates that that extortion is felony punishable by imprisonment of not more than 10 years or a fine not more than $10,000 or both. That mirrors language in the computer trespass as the maximum violations for the penalty, or excuse me, the felony side of that. And then you see definitions on C. For purpose of this section, we've got computer or data contaminant, which is basically defining that virus or worm that's on the network. Ransomware means a computer or data contaminant or lock that restricts an owner's access to a computer system or computer network in any way. And then on page 3, one of the key pieces of this legislation is really enabling is it provides original jurisdiction to our Division of Criminal Investigations, DCI, such that they can originate prosecution or investigation at the state level rather than having to go down to the county level where they would typically have to initiate that for an extortion investigation. So it provides more flexibility to the state and the division that currently does a lot of those criminal prosecutions and investigations related to cyber crimes. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd like to go to Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 on Senate File 33. Hopefully everybody has a copy of that. I've got a provisional copy. And what we see on page 1, line 15, is a concept about making it a violation to attempt to introduce. So we're adding language on line 15 after introduces, comma, attempts to introduce, comma, or directs or induces another to introduce. So in other words, if you have the intent to commit this crime and that's demonstrated, that too could be a violation of it. The second portion of the amendment deletes on page 2, line 19, the word or lock. We had testimony in committee that indicated that's not a very clear term of art and was superfluous, so that was eliminated by the committee. And then page 2, line 20, after way, it was recommended to be explicit that ransomware does not include authentication required to upgrade or access purchased content. In other words, if there's a requirement to access additional content of the software by design, that's not ransomware, even if you don't want to pay it. Mr. Chairman, that's the legislation. I'd answer questions, or if there are no questions on the Standing Committee Amendment number 1, I would call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, I'm not entirely sure I did, so I think Senator Christensen may have. If not, for the record, I move Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 33 and ask the body for favorable consideration.
Is there any discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 33, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Back on the bill. Any further discussion on the bill? Mr. Vice President.
Mr. Chairman, a question on page 2, line 2, where it says, which requires the payment of money, where it says that if you put the ransomware in there, then you must demand money. What happens if you don't demand money? Can you put ransomware on somebody's computer? And by the way, use the word malware when you're talking about the first page there. Should we have malware in there, too? So there's two questions there. Should we have malware alongside ransomware, or they mean the same thing, because I really don't know myself. And on line 2 where it says requires payment, what if they don't require a payment, they just steal your data?
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I jumped up to add a question to the mix because it's related to the questions posed by the Vice President. My curiosity, and I commend the work on this bill, my curiosity is whether or not the definition of ransomware would include something that is placed on someone's computer that may not be requesting repayment of any kind. In other words, there are things that people can do to your computer such as recordingware or whatever. I just wonder if this bill covers such things, or if there was any discussion during the interim with our committee in that regard. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To address those concerns, with regard to whether or not a payment is required, a circumstance where there wouldn't be a payment would be covered by other provisions explicitly within that same Article 5. So Article 5, 504 is crimes against computer users and penalties. That's based on hacking. There's computer trespass is 506, and you also have some violations in 503 and 502 that would be relevant. So that's legislation that we adopted in the computer trespass 3 years ago, I think, that addresses the type of concern where you're not explicitly extorting. This is requiring some type of remuneration for freeing it up, and you've got the combination of an extortion event with some type of hacking or damaging event, and that's what sort of separates it out as a bit of a different crime and concept, Mr. Chairman. With regard to the malware is also criminal under the computer trespass concept from a couple of years ago, and there's even some better discussion of malware in that section. When we're talking about malware in this discussion, the idea is that you've got a series of different possibilities, viruses, worms, malware, etc., as a potential mechanism for getting to the ransomware. Where you've got an infection on the computer that deposits the ransomware, and there are a number of different mechanisms that can make that happen. It could be a phishing, it could be a Trojan, malware. There's some different terms of art. There's lots of different ways to deploy. But the concept being it's going to lock down some of your resources and data, and then there will be an ask for some type of compensation for that in a typical extortion engagement. Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, question relating to page 3. As I understood the discussion and the introduction of the initial description of the bill, the division was going to have some authority to prosecute it, and it looks to me like the lead-in is the division shall investigate. They're going to investigate these crimes, but then am I right in thinking they maybe can investigate them, but they still have to go through the county prosecuting attorneys to get them prosecuted? Is that right, or is there something else changing here?
Any further discussion, Senator Rothfuss?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding was that the investigation could lead to charges brought by the state. I could double-check that. I don't know that we heard that explicitly. This is modeled after, or it's an extension of, existing criminal prosecution rights that DCI has, so it would be under the same mechanism they've used for child pornography and other investigations. But, Mr. Chairman, I'll look into it to see if they then have to file back through the county prosecutor or if there is another mechanism for that. And I'm not certain. It sounds like I'm getting people mouthing county at me based on their experience, so my suspicion is that might be the way it goes, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what's going on here is that if you go, Mr. Chairman, and look at 91618, which is what you're trying to do is just provide additional jurisdiction to the Department of Criminal Investigation to go look at this. And so this could be prosecuted by the local law enforcement, but this provides then the ability and the resources because for the members of the CID to go and then investigate is the way I understand it. So this is just – this would be necessary – this provision is necessary if we want the Department of with the Criminal Investigation Division to actually come in and actually have the authority to assist with this. It is a crime, so any of your local prosecutors could do it, and so ultimately it still has to come back, and there still has to be an information, or we do have provisions for grand jury, but they never get used, but you would have to be an information filed, and then the prosecution would occur wherever they brought the charges, which is, I'm assuming it would be from the in the county where the complainant was and the investigation occurred, would be my assumption, for the extent that that helps, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I can understand how that would work if you have the victim is in Wyoming, the perpetrator is in Wyoming, we can clearly prosecute him one way or another, whether it's the state does it or the county does it. I understand that. Mr. Chairman, suppose, however, we discover the victim's in Wyoming, but the offender is in Colorado. Do we have jurisdiction to extradite him, because it is a felony here, or is that something that we can't reach him because where he is in Colorado, and it has to be prosecuted by the feds or somebody else under one of their laws? And then the same question, I guess it might be impractical to try to extradite somebody from some foreign country, but that's a different circumstance. So if we could have a little elaboration on that, Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate it.
Further discussion? Senator Perkins.
You know, for a trust lawyer to be venturing into this area is really scary. But anyway, and I have some of these exact same notes down here. It's sometimes called long-arm jurisdiction and other things like that. And so generally, I mean, ultimately the state has to find some way or some nexus with the state to exercise this jurisdiction. And normally, speaking in a broad sense, is when the effects of you generally have jurisdiction in the jurisdiction where the effects of the crime are felt. And so if you do that, you have that. Obviously, there is a whole lot of logistical difficulties that anybody who's investigating wants to bring this to prosecution. My guess is that very rarely would we find the perpetrator of these types of offenses existing within the state of Wyoming. And so, but we do have. I mean, ultimately, you can't perpetrate a fraud in Wyoming and then not be in Wyoming and hide about it. So you do end up with some long-arm jurisdiction. You end up with jurisdiction because the effects of the crime are felt in Wyoming. So generally, that's in broad constitutional terms, that's how you were able to get jurisdiction and prosecute a crime from someone who has never entered into Wyoming. The effects of his crime are felt and realized in Wyoming. That allows you to do it. There'll be issues, though. There'll be obviously extradition issues. We do that now, I think, with some of the child pornography that we have. Our state's had a long history and has been a leader in investigating and finding and dealing with purveyors of child pornography over the Internet. The same types of issues there. But when the effects of the crime are, I believe that's going to give Wyoming, or at least that would be the claim that gives Wyoming. Also provides an opportunity to provide those referrals over to the jurisdiction because it could be very likely those might be crimes in that jurisdiction as well as referring, since it's, if it goes across state lines, might involve the FBI as well. So it does create those things, but they're not any different than the number of the other Internet crimes and other things they're dealing with now, would be my guess.
Any further discussion? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the committee as a whole rises to report, it does so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 33, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 33 has passed committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 31. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 31, Genetic Information Privacy, an act relating to genetic information privacy, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee, was referred to Committee Number 1, which reports back a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Kinski, Nethercott, excused Senator Hicks. Senator Christensen, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 31, Genetic Information Privacy. Senator Rothfuss will be presenting the bill, the file.
Senator Rothfuss, Mr. Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this is another piece of legislation which is being sponsored by the Judiciary Committee but was worked in the interim by the Digital Information Privacy Task Force. This legislation is based on a number of other states that had previously looked into privacy protections for genetic information, so basically your DNA, your sequence, the information that might tell traits and markers about you. Do you have a predisposition for heart disease? Anything else along those lines that might be information that now, as we develop advanced technologies related to DNA and sequencing, you can glean a lot about a person if you have their genetic information, and this tries to provide some statutory protections. At this point in time, Mr. Chairman, there are no protections on your personal DNA as being personally identifiable information or protected information, so this tries to clarify that. What the task force did is basically look around the country. A number of other states have passed legislation along these lines. We tried to get the best that we saw and put together a few other states that had complete and thorough digital or genetic information privacy, and this is the product that we came forward with. You can see on page 2 we've got definitions, and the concept of the definitions is going to get at who is allowed to have the information and transact this genetic information, what characterizes it, and how that information can be transferred. So you see that we've got authorized representative, which is going to mean a person authorized by state or federal law to make healthcare decisions for an individual. DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid. That's a good definition there. Genetic analysis is a test of an individual's DNA gene products or chromosomes to determine a presence or absence of genetic characteristic. You see genetic characteristic designed and genetic information defined below. And then a key concept here on page 3 is the definition of informed consent, which means the signing of a consent form by an individual, et cetera, that allows for some of these things to be engaged with. But one of the key concepts about signing, which we had testimony related to, is remember we have in statute within our definition of signing an allowance for electronic signatures. So there was a lot of discussion about whether or not you can opt in through some online forms and other types of considerations. So that's elsewhere in statute. It makes it very clear that electronic signatures would be allowed. At the bottom of page 3, Mr. Chairman, genetic testing prohibitions and exceptions indicates that no person conducting genetic analysis shall do any of the following without the informed consent of that individual. Moving on to page 4, you have to have informed consent to obtain an individual's genetic information, perform genetic analysis, retain that information, disclose the information, which is all reasonable, and then we see we've got some exceptions on page 4, paragraph B, where those exceptions beginning in Romanet 1 would allow disclosure or obtaining or retaining to the individual or the individual's authorized representative without informed consent or written consent, basically, allow disclosure to law enforcement where otherwise authorized by law. On page 5, Romanet 3 indicates that the exception exists for the state DNA database or comparable provisions of other jurisdictions, the sex offender registration, determining paternity in Romanet 5, on Romanet 6, determining identity of a deceased individual, newborn screening pursuant to statute on 7, Romanet 8, the provision of emergency medical treatment, Romanet 9, an order of a court, Romanet 10, anonymous research where the identity of the individual will not be released. So the concept here is if I want to obtain genetic information or do some type of genetic testing, but it's anonymized throughout the research process, that would be allowed. And there are rigorous standards that go into human testing, and there's a lot of additional requirements elsewhere in statute and in federal statute when you're handling that would govern. And then Romanet 11 would provide an exception for services limited to storage, retrieval, handling, or transmission of genetic information by a third-party service provider pursuant to a contract or other obligation. The concept here is if you are an Internet service provider and you're transmitting it from one point to another, that is not, if it's pursuant to a contract, then you would not have to have written or informed consent. If you're the data storage entity and you're running and operating the cloud, you would be operating pursuant to a contract when you're moving the data from one place to another. You don't have to explicitly get that informed consent yourself. So if you're not the originator of it, you can work through that client and that informed consent is going to govern. On page 6, 3531, 103, genetic information inspection and retention provides some details and allowances for the individual and what their rights and authorities would be. You see in paragraph A, an individual or that individual's authorized representative may inspect, correct, or obtain genetic information about the individual. So if you have information about me, I am capable of requesting that from you. Paragraph B indicates that if I want you to destroy that information, you have to do so unless Romanet 1, the information was obtained pursuant to one of the exceptions earlier, or Romanet 2, retention is necessary based on some type of agreement we have with informed consent. Paragraph C is a loophole closer, which basically says that if you obtained that genetic information through one of the exceptions, you have to eliminate it or abide by the rest of statute once that exception no longer applies. So if you no longer need it for law enforcement purposes, you don't just keep holding on to it. If you're no longer on or you no longer need to determine the identity of a deceased individual because, well, you already did so, you don't maintain it. So it tries to close the loopholes after the fact when it's no longer needed. Mr. Chairman, on page 7 at the bottom, the criminal penalties as well as a private right of action indicate that there's a person violating the provisions of this chapter is guilty of a misdemeanor punishable by a fine of not more than $1,000 for each violation, and B is that private right of action allowing that individual to enjoin or restrain any violation of this chapter and may, in the same action, seek damages based on the violations of the genetic information privacy. Mr. Chairman, that's the legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any further discussion? Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, back on page 7, bottom 7, 8, the private cause of action, the civil cause of action, I'm trying to figure out, I'm sure that sometime in the future the answer to this will be apparent, but right now, if somebody hacked somebody else's computer and got my my genetic information, how do you assess what the damage is? If somebody illegally has my genetic sequence, if they don't do anything else with it, although they didn't obtain it legally, all right, there is the criminal penalties, and that's pretty clear. But what are the damages? How do you determine what the damages are to me because somebody else has my genetic sequencing?
Further discussion? Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
So, yeah, thank you. And that was interesting. I didn't even think about that. But so, like, if they use this against, if they violated this and I ended up having to pay child support because they violated, do they have to pay my child support for me? But my real question is on B, I just wondering if I'm reading this wrong. It's on page 4, lines 13 through 18. And so this is where we come up with the exceptions, when you can use genetic information without being obtained, without permission, without the informed consent. And so we've got a genetic individual's information may be obtained, retained, disclosed, or used without informed consent. And so you start down those things. And the first one is for disclosures to the individual or the individual's authorized representative. So as I look at that, does that create a loophole that subsumes everything? So if an agency or another individual illegally obtains my genetic information, as long as they disclose it to me under I, are they somehow then off the hook for all the other issues there because they disclosed it to me? I was struggling to understand B and B Romanet 1 and how that fits in, but it looks to me like potentially if I'm reading that, you might just be able to disclose it. As long as you disclose to that person after the fact, you get to use it for whatever you want to use it. Is that a big loophole, or am I just reading that wrong?
Further discussion? Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, this is kind of a silly thing, but what if 20 years ago a certain president and a woman wearing a blue dress happened in Wyoming? And so she has that DNA. Is she subject to Part B on page 7 and 8?
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To address those concerns, first of all, the good senator from the North on his cause of action and the assessment of damages, that would be determined by the courts pursuant to how we do other things. The actual calculation, I'm not entirely sure what they would use for an algorithm or whether there's anything out there right now for the damages. But again, if you're assessing damages, then you have to be able to demonstrate some reasonable justification for those damages. The court would then have to agree with that. If it was a circumstance, as you said, where they stole it, but they didn't damage you in any way, I think you might have a difficult time with this private right of action of getting damages out of the court, but there still would be the penalty provision in place. So I think, again, consistent with the way we would otherwise do things with that private right of action and potential damages available. With regard to my good friend, the majority leader, this provision of Romanet 1 was put there based on consideration of if you have an individual that wants to talk to their doctor about the genetic information in some way and without having to sign a waiver. That's the concept, is you actually have a doctor-patient relationship or something along those lines where your genetic information has been collected on your behalf. You need to, I'm sorry, yeah, I moved too far away from my microphone. So the genetic information is being collected on your behalf. You want to be able to have that conversation without having to fill out forms. That was kind of the basis for it. Now, I understand the concept and the concern of the way it's been phrased, where that might provide some type of a workaround. And we can visit that language and see if there's a better way to say that. I hope you understand the purpose of the language, but I do see the concern, and there might be a way to fix that and tighten it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Oh, Mr. Chairman, we had one more. My apologies. With regard to a circumstance where you basically have some DNA evidence that's obtained by a third party, there could be criminal prosecution. You have obtained a sample which is genetic information about another. You might have some type of action, but you are, let's see, you are at that point undertaking genetic investigation of a third party. Based on the way this is written, I would say that it is the third party or the originator of the genetic information that would basically have ownership, and if you didn't provide consent to it, you don't have informed consent, then you would not be able to, under provision A, obtain that individual's genetic information. So you wouldn't be able to run the sequence and keep it just because you got a genetic sample. And a more straightforward example of that would be if I just walked by you and brushed some skin cells off of you, I could run genetic analysis on that too. And then I could obtain your sequence, and then I could do all sorts of scary and malicious science fiction-esque things with that information. But based on this, obtaining that genetic information would potentially be a violation, as I understand the phrasing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I want to ask a question that gets a bit into the research realm. The technology we have now for obtaining genetic information from some sample of tissue, blood, anything we've got from an individual is well beyond anything we could have imagined 20 or 30 years ago. And this bill contemplates consent from the individual, but you start reaching back on some kind of information we had, say you had a series of blood samples that were drawn 30 years ago, you wouldn't have had consent. Nobody would have thought it was an issue to get genetic information out of it. Now you can. If it's anonymized research, I think that's covered. But suppose your research purpose in looking at those samples is, A, it's some kind of biomedical research. You know who the sample came from. They're long dead, but they have descendants. You discover some kind of problem, and it's in the interest of those descendants to know that because they may have the same problem and they may want to be tested for it. Does this reach that circumstance so that that information cannot be passed on to those descendants without getting you in trouble under this, because you obviously can't go back and get consent from the individual the sample originally came from? They're 6 feet under. Same circumstance, except your purpose is maybe some people are extraordinarily interested in genealogical information, and having those blood samples tested may well be very useful in that kind of a search. You can't get consent, again, because the individual's dead. But maybe you have a lock of hair from somebody, and you want to know, is that an ancestor or not? You can't get consent, again, because they're gone. How does this affect that sort of thing?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's an interesting discussion, and we obviously addressed some concepts about decedent privacy rights last year with legislation where we tried to protect the privacy of electronic accounts of the dead unless there was some type of explicit proclamation of rights or release of that information. So if there was a will or something in place, an instrument in place that would allow for that, otherwise it would be protected. This legislation, unless there is some type of legal consent given, would indicate that you wouldn't be allowed to do that with knowledge of the individual. Now, that's a policy decision, but it would open an interesting can of worms if all you had to do was wait for somebody to be dead, and then you freely got to know all of the information about them. One of the concerns with genetic information privacy is what you can do with that information. You can know a lot about people. You can know a lot about their background. You can know a lot about their potential health and health history, and you can know their ancestry and their progeny's potential health. So I understand there's some positive research purposes there, but there's also some potentially nefarious purposes for that. And, Mr. Chairman, to the good senator from Natrona County's question, I think that's a very, very deep and sticky possible consideration, whether or not this passes. There's a lot there to that question that's probably not covered in any of the existing statute and probably not fully covered in the decedent privacy rights, because I don't think we explicitly mentioned any genetic information. So with or without this legislation, that's an interesting future.
Further discussion? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion, when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 31, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 31 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for Mr. Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor, please?
You may.
Mr. Chairman, the other body has adjourned, and we'd like to get back to Joint Appropriations Agency hearings. So if the members of the Joint Appropriations Committee could meet me down at that room, we'll go ahead and continue with our hearing so we're not going on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. All right. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 30. Will the reading clerk please read the bill? Mr. Minority Floor Leader.
Senate File 30, Jail Placement Coordination, an act relating to counties, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee, was referred to Committee Number 1, which returned a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Kinski, and Nethercott, excused Senator Hicks. Senator Christensen, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable consideration on Senate File 30, Jail Placement Coordination. There is an amendment. I would ask that that amendment be read in, and I move that amendment.
Will the reading clerk read the amendments?
Senate File 30, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 22.
Senator Christensen, you need to move that amendment now. Once
yes.
It's been read in, please. Thank you.
I move that amendment, and for the explanation of the bill and the timing of the amendment, I'd ask Senator Anselmi to take her first time at Committee of the Whole.
Thank you, Senator Christensen. Senator Anselmi, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate. This piece of legislation originated because a county in the northwest part of our great state of Wyoming requested to rent out their space, and they weren't sure if they had the authority to do so. So this legislation authorizes contracts to house out-of-state prisoners in county jails. And so, and on page one, what happens is it's subject to the approval by the county commissioners, and then the sheriff has the authority, local control, to contract with another state. for housing of prisoners in his county jail. On page 2, line 1, basically they say that the sheriff will be responsible for the safekeeping of the out-of-state prisoner, and that any funds paid by the other outside state will be credited to the general fund of that county. So as a hotelier, I have experience with this. When you run a business, the fixed costs keep the same, and if it's just as expensive to run a half-full hotel almost as it is to run a full hotel. So this is just giving some money to the counties to give them the ability to rent out their space, heads and beds, we call it. So a contract then goes on line 8. What happens here on line 8, page 2, section B, we add some legal protection for these contracts where we say that it will not impact the ability of the county to house county prisoners, and they won't house felons. These are misdemeanor crimes in section 2 and Romanet 3. They say they won't require services, which the jail does not currently provide, i.e., if the northern state from us has a large reading library and we have a small one, that's all the jail has to provide is what they have. And Romanet 4, they provide flexibility to the sheriff to reject or return prisoners. And this is where our standing committee amendment deletes on line 22 within, and on line 23 within 30 days. And so are there any questions on the can we have a vote on the standing committee amendment?
Thank you, Senator Anselmi. Are there any questions or discussion on standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate file 30? Seeing none. All those in favor of, my apologies, Senator Barnard.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. Suppose that an inmate is transferred to a jail, and then while he's there, he has to have an appendectomy, which costs a lot of money, or some kind of operation. I don't see anything in this provision here that says that the person who sent them has to pay for that. So if that jail sends a patient to a hospital, that hospital is going to bill that jail. Does that jail have the opportunity to then transfer that to the person that sent them, that prisoner?
Thank you. Senator Barnard, we are on Standing Committee Amendment number 1. It's specific to the within and within 30 days. Do we have any discussion on Standing Committee Amendment number 1? Senator Hicks, on Standing Committee Amendment number 1.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a little discussion. If we go to the bill and you look at the amendment on page 2, line 23, it strikes out the words 30 days, but then it leads the words days if. And I'm just wondering if that was a mistake in that amendment to not strike out those additional words, or what's the rationale for leaving those last two words on line 23 in there?
Thank you, Senator Hicks. Are there any further questions before the sponsor takes? Sorry, Senator Anselmi.
The amendment actually just leaves the word if, because we would then that he would be able to reject or return prisoners to the state of origin if, and then we go on into A and B.
Thank you, Senator. Never mind is what I'm hearing from the audience. Okay, sounds good. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, floor leader. Mr. Chairman, as a in a prior life, being a former county commission and having done this numerous times to help defray costs of maintaining the jail, you certainly could add it in here, but and it might not necessarily be a bad idea, but those contracts, you actually have a contract with whatever entity is providing those prisoners, and you really hope your county attorney is smart enough to put in there an indemnification clause for all medical expenses and any other types of expenses caused, which is a pretty standard.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, are we on the amendment?
No, I'm sorry. Are we? Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
You know what?
Thank you.
Never mind.
Thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. Is there? All right. It's the first day of Committee of the Whole. Does anyone have a question or discussion on the couple of words that are Standing Committee Amendment number 1? Seeing none and hearing the question called, all those in favor of Senator Christian's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 30, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has passed. We are back on the Senate file, Senate File 30. Is there any discussion on Senate File 30? I think there is. Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe our presenter has finished presenting the bill.
Senator Christensen, that's a good point. Senator Anselmi.
Okay, now I'm going to finish presenting the bill. I think we got to that amendment very clearly. Good job. So let's all now work forward. That was tricky, I know. Okay, so now we're on page 3. We finished from page 2 to say that the page 2, we say, provide flexibility to the sheriff to reject or return prisoners if the jail has reached its capacity. That's on page 3, section A, line 2, and on 5, line 5, or on line 6, excuse me, the prisoner is a security or safety risk to the jail. And this act would be effective line 9 on page 3, effective July 1st, 2017. And I would ask for favorable consideration if there are no questions.
Thank you, Senator Anselmi. Any discussion on Senate File 30? Who wants to go first? Senator Perkins.
Never mind what I said before, if you would, please.
Thank you. Okay. Sure. All right, good. Thank you, Senator Perkins. Senator Barnard, did you want to redo yours?
Some of the remarks by the majority floor leaders cleared up my questions.
That's beautiful. Finish the presentation, all the questions go away. Thank you, Senator Barnard. Any discussion on Senate File 30? Seeing none, hearing the question called for, all those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 30, please say aye. Opposed, no. Senate File 30 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 20. The reading clerk will read the Senate file.
Senate File 20, Student Digital Information Privacy, an act relating to education, sponsored by the Education Committee, was referred to Committee Number 4, which returned a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Coe, Ellis, I'm sorry, Mr. President. Committee number 4 returned a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Coe, Ellis, Pappas, and Rothfuss. Noes, Senator Wasserberger. Senator Coe, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Coe.
Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 20, and I'll defer to Senator Rothfuss when I replace him up in the chair.
Thank you, Senator Coe.
Senator Rothfuss.
I got it on. No, I don't. First day of the uniform.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Coe.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 20, Student Digital Information Privacy, is a piece of legislation sponsored by the Education Committee, but was developed by the Digital Information Privacy Task Force last year through the interim. It was brought to the legislature. We worked it, as you may recall, last session in the Senate. There were some concerns with a few of the provisions in it. When it got to the other chamber, there were further concerns. So we decided that we would bring it back to the Digital Information Privacy Task Force to address those concerns, and we come back with a much stronger version of the legislation. The concept here, to summarize, Mr. Chairman, is that this legislation protects K-12 students
from privacy, potential privacy invasions, where their username and password for private personal accounts are being required to be released by administrators or folks at the schools. So going through the legislation you see on page 2, the key provision here, the key concept on paragraph A is that no officer or employee of a school district organized within the state shall, and then Romanet 1 gets to the heart of it, require a student or prospective student to disclose or to provide access to a digital information account through the student's or prospective student's username, password, or other means of authentication that provides access. That's the core concept. So a school can't say, I need the username and password for your personal email account. That's forbidden then by the Romanet 1. Romanet 2 indicates that you can't just say, well, if I can't ask you for the username and password, why don't you just log in for me, and then I'll look around. Romanet 3 says you can't ask for their smartphone or other electronic communication device to gain access to that private information. And Romanet 4 indicates that you can't ask someone to add you to their private network, their private friends group, their associations that would then let you gain access to what would otherwise be private material. On page 3, Romanet 5 prohibits expulsion or discharging or discipline for failure to or refusal to admit to those requirements of the previous provisions. And Romanet 6 indicates that you can't require a student or prospective student to waive or limit any protection granted under this section. Now, Mr. Chairman, for those that debated this last year, there was a little bit different language that's worth pointing out. Last year, it was require or request a student to provide this information, with the concept that if you're making a request as somebody who's an official in the school, that sounds a lot like a requirement sometimes. But one of the things that we worked on in the interim was a way around that, so that you can now request. You'll be fine to request and have a conversation with the student, but you'll see a little bit later in the piece of legislation, Mr. Chairman, that if you're going to make that request and have the conversation, you have to make it clear to the student that it is not a requirement, that it is a request. So that's how we tried to meet that middle ground that was asked for from last session. The bottom of page 3 in paragraph B, we have some exclusions indicating that nothing in this section shall prohibit an officer or employee of a school district from, and you see conducting an investigation related to school policies and other compliance and applicable law, as long as you don't require disclosure of that digital information account username and password. Romanet 2 is an essential point, and what Romanet 2 on page 4 says is that nothing stops the school from saying, we're bringing in your parents. As a matter of fact, that's the bright line, that's the key concept. If you have a situation where you need some private information or something that the child might have on a personal email account or a personal social media account, the key recourse in this is that Romanet 2, which says you can bring in the parents and you can ask them for the information. So you're entitled to do that because theoretically the parents are going to understand the legal consequences and what the rights are of the minor, and that would then be an appropriate way to handle a situation by school administrators and school teachers. Page 4, Romanet 3, there's no prohibition to viewing, assessing, or utilizing information about a student or prospective student that is publicly available or self-reported. This was another request from last year, the self-reported concept. So if somebody is being cyberbullied, for example, and they come forward and say, I want you to see this, this is Bobby giving me a hard time, look at this, you're absolutely entitled to do that. You can use that for your investigation. That's permissible. Or even from a third-party standpoint where somebody comes forward and says, I want you to see what's going on. This is horrible. So that protects that access, and that, based on testimony, is probably the most common way that we hear that those types of cyberbullying incidences are reported. And then Romanet 4, nothing prohibits obtaining an electronic communication device of a student for the purpose of providing information technology support. So that's a circumstance where if you've got an IT person and the student says, hey, I need help with my phone or I need help with my computer, could you help me? It provides flexibility there, which was another concern that we had heard. On page 5, some more conditions you see in paragraph C. This is an important one. Nothing in this section shall apply to an account opened, created, or provided by a school district. If the student has been provided advance notice, the account may be monitored, et cetera. So in other words, if it's a school district account, say an email address provided by the school district and the policy says we get to read whatever's on it, that's just fine. The policy says you get to read whatever's on it. It's not the property of the student. It's not their personal private property. It's the school district's property, and there's no protection for that. Paragraph D, nothing in this section shall be construed to prohibit or restrict a student or prospective student from self-disclosing a username, password, or other means of authentication that provides access to the student or prospective student's digital information account if the student or prospective student has been provided advance notice that the disclosure is voluntary. This gets back at the concept that there can be a request for the type of information, but you have to make it clear that it's voluntary to do so. Paragraph E provides that there is no creation of a duty for an officer or employee of a school district to search or monitor activity of students. Paragraph F indicates that if access to private information is gained through any of the previous exceptions or provisions, that the student's parents or guardians must be informed within 24 hours. Paragraph G on page 6 provides for a definition of digital information account, which is an electronic service or account used to communicate or store digital assets. And then the second half of page 6 just incorporates a requirement for the local school board of trustees to ensure compliance with this statute. Mr. Chairman, that's the legislation, and there certainly is contention surrounding this. It's a balance of privacy interests and privacy rights of K-12 students versus needs for access. And the intent, Mr. Chairman, for this legislation is to draw a line which basically says if it's important enough or a critical enough circumstance that you need access to a student's private data, their personal account, you should bring in the parents or the police, or both. If it is not important enough to bring in the parents or the police, you probably shouldn't be searching that child's private account. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions? We do have a committee of the whole, Senator Hicks.
Yep, Mr. Chairman, just one question, just for my edification. Could somebody give me a definition of what a prospective student is? Just want to clarify, because it uses that repeatedly through the language. So is this somebody that's not even enrolled in the school at that time? So just a little definition on that, please.
Further discussion?
We want that now, Mr. Chairman. Immediately. Mr. Chairman, a prospective student would be a student that is not yet enrolled, but perhaps as a condition of enrollment, you say something like, well, you know, you're coming to this school beforehand. We would like to see private access to your social media page or something along those lines. That's the concept. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion? We do have a committee of the whole. Senator. We do have a committee of the whole amendment. Reading clerk, please read in the committee of the whole amendment.
Senate File 20, Committee of the Whole Amendment, number 1, page 4, after line 21.
Senator Wasserberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File number 20 and would ask for your favorable vote. Essentially, after discussion in our committee this morning, there was some discussion about school administrators dealing with emergencies within their school. And in my estimation, you know, sometimes if it's a case of suicide or a weapon in your school, it's seconds. Seconds are involved in how fast you respond to that issue. And so essentially what this amendment says, on page line 16, it says, nothing in this section shall prohibit an officer or employee of a school district. And then on page 4, line 21, the amendment in the amendment says, in the reasonable course of preventing or attempting to prevent immediate and serious bodily harm to any person, requiring access to a student's or prospective student's electronic communication device for the purpose of observing the contents of the student's or prospective student's digital information account. And essentially what that says, if there is a situation where a student is threatening bodily harm to himself, which would cover suicides, or anyone else, which would cover your bullying, the threat of a fight, a weapon, then the school administrator could respond quickly and take care of the issue. I would ask for your favorable vote. I think it's an issue of school safety, and so I urge you to vote aye.
Further discussion on the Committee of the Whole Amendment. Senator Kinski.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I'm rising on behalf of my good colleague from the North, who was off at an Appropriations Committee meeting. He asked me to convey along a concern that was raised to him by a local school district, and this would be pertaining to the amendment. The particular concern was that the school district, this particular district, would like it to be clear that it need, in hindsight, it need not have been an actual threat. If the circumstances are such that they reasonably believed there was a reasonable prospect of imminent harm to another or to themselves. So I wonder if I simply submit that for the good amendment sponsor's consideration, if not now, perhaps at a subsequent point to further clarify the amendment. And I wonder what the amendment sponsor might, how he might feel about an amendment to put that subjective reasonable belief into this language. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion? Further discussion? Senator Ruffus.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. Senator Case was up. And
Senator Case. Let's go to Senator Case first.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. You know, I was part of the Digital Information Privacy Task Force, and we had kind of a discussion about this on the floor last year. We rehashed it in the task force. It, for me, it comes down to why do we take children in schools and have the Constitution doesn't apply to them as well as it does to everybody else. I think that just sends a terrible signal to them. You know, they're citizens of our nation. Granted, they're not old enough, but the bill is all throughout trying to thread this, getting the parents involved and that kids have rights. And this sort of says, yeah, but we can do everything else. And then if it has the Second Amendment that was the subsequent amendment, I meant to say, that was discussed, that would weaken it even further, I worry about that. Let's talk about the situation where there is a true emergency. I think we would act. That's what I would do if I was an administrator. I would act. I would try to, you know, and I think that that would be okay. I really do. But I think this opens a loophole that deprives students in Wyoming of the Constitution. I think that's a terrible signal to send.
Senator Washberger.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that is an excellent point. And the point and the response to that is the United States Supreme Court declared many, many years ago in Tinker versus Des Moines that students don't shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate. That's a direct quote from that case, and they don't. But their rights are not the same as an adult's. An adult has those rights guaranteed them in the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights. But students have a lesser level of rights because of the issue of school safety. And so the Supreme Court have, for many, many years, has said, just like we say in juvenile cases, where punishment is not going to be as severe as an adult, there are two different justice systems, one for juveniles and one for adults. The same is true in our schools. Over decades of time, the Supreme Court has given administrators the right to do more than you would as if you were an adult. And so students have those rights. They have constitutional rights, but they're not the same as an adult.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, when you look at this proposed amendment, it really brings a dilemma here with the bill. On the one hand, we reasonably want to protect the students from unwarranted snooping in their private affairs by school people. And I can see, particularly as you get into high school students and whatnot, they might well be offended by an administrator wanting to snoop into their private email. On the other hand, if we don't have this amendment, and this amendment, even if further so-called weakened by protecting the school people from saying if they reasonably thought there might be something, they can look. Sooner or later, Mr. Chairman, this bill is going to cause a tragedy. Because you're talking about an age where we know there is a suicide risk in this age, this group, in this state. We have a special problem. And where we also know we have problems on occasion with some real cyberbullying that can be very disruptive of another student's life, their ability to go to school and look positively in the school experience and get the most out of it they can. So this really is a balancing. And I would urge the Senate to come down on the side of we need to tolerate some risk of snooping that will be offensive in order to protect the life of students where there may be a threat, where the threat may be suicide, threat may be some kind of harm to other students. I think that is more important than trying to do away with, than trying to be ultra cautious about protecting privacy. It's a matter of judgment. You're going to do some harm either way. But I would, Mr. Chairman, let's get our priorities straight and let's let the school people have the authority and the ability they need to protect our young people.
Further discussion, Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, on and for the amendment, and sometimes I think we have these discussions about the legal aspects, and sometimes we forget there's a higher law than the Constitution of the United States. We have a moral law and an obligation to our fellow man, and especially our children, to afford them every protection that we can as adults. So while we can debate these issues of the legal realms of this as whether we should or shouldn't and the constitutional law, I think we also need to recognize sometimes there's a higher law and that we have an obligation under those laws too. And probably first and foremost is to look after the youth of our country.
Back on the amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have four kids, and I think everybody knows that, and they mean more to me than anything else. I would not be running this legislation if I thought it was a potential risk to their lives or made their lives worse, Mr. Chairman. And, I do value their individual privacy and their individual rights and their constitutional rights. And I think it's important that when they're at school, that I can have confidence also that they're being protected by that school. If there was ever a circumstance when suicide was a consideration, or a weapon, or violence, or injury, or potential harms, I would not expect the administrator to take unilateral action to invade my child's privacy. I would expect them to call the police and call me as quickly as is humanly possible. And if it's not that important where I should get a phone call or the police should get a phone call, how can it be important enough to invade or overcome their privacy rights? It's the same for us. You think about it for us as adults. There has to be a warrant. There has to be probable cause. There has to be law enforcement. There's a lot that goes into the privacy rights at our level and a lot of case law. And it is absolutely true, as the good senator from Campbell County points out, that there's different case law related to children. What this tries to do is present a bright line, a clear line, which indicates that there is recourse. And try to think through scenarios. And for 2 years, I've been working on this legislation. For 2 years, I've been asking the same question. What is a scenario? What is one example where the right course of action isn't to call the police or call the parents, but it is to say, Timmy, give me your username and password. I need it. Please? Come on, Timmy, give me your username and password. Come on, give it to me. There's nothing that indicates that a child that is seriously involved in a potential threat, that is the key linchpin behind that, is going to immediately disclose any information. So what you would reasonably do if you had that student in front of you and their device was with them was say, come with me to the office. I hope that's what would happen. And then you would have the opportunity to call the parents, call the police, and manage the situation as you should. If that person isn't there, but you have somebody else there that potentially has information, well, the legislation as drafted says you can certainly say, I need the information. It's very important that we have the information about Betty. Could you show that to me? It's voluntary, but I would really appreciate it. And if it's important, you'll certainly get a response, or you can call that individual's parents. Mr. Chairman, a lot of thought went into scenarios on this. And I understand that as soon as we start talking about children and suicide, the natural inclination, which is one that I join and share in, is, all right, we need to make sure that doesn't happen. But, Mr. Chairman, I would say that this legislation, in my view, would be more likely to prevent a suicide. Social media is private information. When I access your social media account, it's not just you that I get to learn about. If I access your email account, I learn about a lot of people pretty quickly. When you have people who have emotional problems and difficulties, a lot of times they communicate that with their friends and their peer group. Imagine if the students didn't feel like they could trust that to be secure, because all it would take would be somebody to come along and say, disclose your information by username and password. Or I had a good reason to go in, but I read a lot more than I probably needed to. Mr. Chairman, I would ask the body to really try and come up with a scenario, a tangible, realistic, likely possibility, or even unlikely possibility, where the amendment solves a problem that isn't already remedied by the original provisions of the bill. Because again, Mr. Chairman, for 2 years I have asked everybody who's come through and raised this concern, and I have yet to hear a single scenario where that could play out that isn't better addressed by calling the parents and calling the police on and against the amendment.
Senator Christensen, let's go to you first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for the amendment, and the quick answer to the good senator's concern is the geography of Wyoming. We live in a community where it is an hour to the sheriff's office on a short drive on good roads. And I think if you apply that distance issue, there most of the counties in the state have similar distance issues where a elementary school or another school may be isolated from a law enforcement response. And as far as the parents go, there are a lot of workplaces or environments that aren't conducive to quick contact on a cell phone, whatever it is, where they're at, job sites. And so that idea of time, I think this amendment goes to time, and I think time is a big issue in a state like Wyoming for as far as a response from law enforcement or a parent.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, on for the amendment and to address my colleagues' concerns about give me a concrete example. Let me give you a concrete example. If you pass this legislation without this amendment, to the unintended consequences. And I share my colleagues' concern that any rational adult, if they know there's a potential of a suicide or some serious consequences by not getting into that email account, is going to go ahead and do it. So let's talk about the unintended consequences of doing that. If you don't include this amendment in this bill, what you've just done is you've made that teacher a criminal for doing the right thing. They're going to face a $1,000 fine. They're going to have on their record misdemeanor that they went in here. If they do, there's nothing in the current bill without this amendment that shields those teachers. They're going to violate this law. Is this really what we want to do in this body, is criminalize things for teachers doing the right thing? So, you know, I think on and for the amendment.
Senator Washburger.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for my final. I can talk forever in the Committee of the Whole, but we've talked this baby forever, and that's enough. Actually, on this bill, there is no fine. There's no $1,000 like was last year when it left this House, and then that was corrected to $500. But what I do want to say is simply this. On the issue of suicide, if a student threatens suicide, typically there's no punishment. I have never known in 34 years of education where a student threatened suicide to him where he was expelled or suspended. It doesn't happen. You get health care, mental health care for that child. There's no punishment. So the next thing I'd like to talk about, and one thing that you haven't probably heard, is that our Safe to Tell program is really making a difference. It is actually, right now, I think that last time I talked to the Attorney General's office, they feel that they positively stopped 3 suicides. And you just have to move fast. Seconds are important. And you don't know for sure. The first thing that you do as a building principal is get that child to your guidance counselor. Get the guidance counselor involved, and the guidance counselor goes through a series of questions to see if that student is really a risk to himself. The vast majority of the times, he is not. He or she is not. But if they are, you get them to the hospital. You get them care. So, and there's no punishment. The next thing I'd like to talk about is our bullying. Not so many years ago, this very body required that we would have a bullying statute, and so I myself was actually in charge of implementing the anti-bullying program at my school. We did it through the OVEAS program, which is research-based, and we actually have, since the last, I think it's been placed for 3 years now, about a 30% decrease in the number of bullying acts in our school. But if the student is threatening through Facebook or any media, social media, if they're using harm, we would be able to move if this amendment is passed. And also, we are also required as educators to report all cases of child abuse. And, of course, in that particular instance, the child is not being threatened with expulsion or suspension. It's a parental issue that we need to report that to the Department of Family Services. So on and in favor of the amendment, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that you give a favorable vote.
Senator Kinski.
Chairman, thank you. On and for the amendment.
Yes.
Point of order?
Yes. Once again, we used the pronoun in here. We used a company's name. Let's try not to do that.
So taken, Senator Kinski.
On and for the amendment. I'm for the amendment because it improves what I think is a bad bill. but I think it improves in a way that we have to just in case the bill passes. And the reason is this. My good friend from the university talked about a bright line rule. There was a time in America when we did have a bright line rule. It was provided to us by the common law, and it was the law of the land in our schools for centuries, and it worked fine. And that rule is in loco parentis, that the school district is going to act in the place of the parent with that child's best interests in mind, and that they're not going to act arbitrarily or randomly or cruelly, but they're going to act in the best interests of that child in place of the parent because the parent's not there. And that was an easy, bright-line rule to operationalize. And that's key because it all comes down to what one teacher thinks at one given moment or the conversation that two teachers have in the teacher's lounge about what do we do if. And not every teacher in the school district has the sophisticated background training and grounding in constitutional law as my friend from Camel Country. It typically comes down to a conversation like this. Can we ask the kid for his phone or not? Now, under in loco parentis, the rule is, if you think you got a problem, ask him for it. Under this approach, it's, you better be sure, or you might lose your house. And you're going to have teachers pulling their punches. You're going to have teachers hesitating. You're going to have a chilling effect on what needs to happen in that school district between that teacher and those students. I'm speaking for the amendment. I think it's going to improve the situation that we've got over the bill as it exists now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion. Senator Ruffus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All good points, but I want to address, the concept of providing a scenario. And a couple of suggestions of scenarios were provided about increased distance as one example, but that's not a scenario. Walk through a real circumstance of what would happen. Try and imagine something actually playing out that would go well if you were demanding a username and password, even if you were remote and you couldn't get the police there quickly. And your expectation was that you were going to rely on demanding a username and password from the student as a way of solving a problem. There's no way you can compel a student to give you that username and password, but you can certainly threaten to kick them out of school. If this is a significant and serious enough situation where that type of concern is warranted, I think you'd be hard-pressed to assume that the student is just going to give in right away and turn over all of the information that would then convict and indict them. That seems unlikely. I can't imagine that scenario. So I would wait the hour for the police to show up under that circumstance and try and get a warrant and try and find access to the information if it was essential. Or I might request the information, because at that point a request and a requirement, it doesn't make much difference. Either they're going to give it to you or they're not going to give it to you. You're just not going to enforce based off of it. And again, that's provided for in the legislation. The idea that you would criminalize it if you were going to go ahead and do it anyway, and that it's made criminal for doing the right thing, as my friend Senator from up in Campbell County pointed out, there's no fine or misdemeanor in this legislation. It's a policy. So you're putting in place a policy for how teachers should handle these circumstances. No one's going to lose their house over it. That's not what's going to happen. But I can tell you that under current law, in another state to the east, this happened. This exactly happened where teachers came in and wanted and required a student without the parent present, without law enforcement present, to disclose their username and password for a major social media account. And that student did that and ended up leaving the school and being homeschooled, and they were embarrassed and they were ridiculed about what ended up occurring afterwards. And going along with that, the school district was sued and settled for $80,000. Based on a violation of their privacy rights. Now, case law is very fuzzy on this. That's one case that's very specific, but it was in a lower court, and it was a settlement. It was not a decision. So it's hard to say exactly what would happen. But this provides clarity, and it provides a line that will not lead to a lawsuit if it's followed. With regard to the concept of in loco parentis, this is challenging because we have a circumstance here where it's not like it was where the child is bringing the backpack into the school and putting it in the locker. We're on school property at that point, Mr. Chairman. Most of the case law and most of in loco parentis assumes that you're at school. Your stuff is at school, and the school has the ability to have authority over what's in the school. This is an email address or a social media account that's in the cloud that may never have been accessed at the school. It's a lot more similar to letters I might have on my desk back home. Do we give a school in loco parentis rights to go into my child's room back home because they think there's some bullying evidence on the letter on the desk? Because that's what this is. It doesn't need to be accessed at school. It doesn't have to in any way, shape, or form be related to the school. I just know that Timmy has an account on a major social media, and I want access to it to find out what happened last Friday. It is very different. That's why in loco parentis is not being constantly ruled on behalf of with the Supreme Court, because the whole concept of information now has changed dramatically, and there is no clear, bright line from that standpoint any longer. This provides a clear line. And again, on and against the amendment, and if the amendment works, I hope you can come up with a concept or a scenario where it's essential and where we fail through the original legislation, because it's a significant erosion of individual privacy rights moving from legislation as written to legislation as amended. And if it's all hypothesis and, well, maybe there's an idea out there, I hope that's not sufficient justification, Mr. Chairman. We need to have some very clear, very real possible scenarios that would justify going into that bedroom back home, digging through the desk drawer, opening a sealed letter, and reading its contents. Because if you can't get to that point, we shouldn't be going into their account in the cloud, Mr. Chairman. On and against.
Senator Washenberger.
Chairman, real quickly, I do want to mention that, first of all, if a school administrator violates the constitutional rights of a student in any way, there's a Civil Rights Act, Section 1983, monetary damages can be awarded to that child if those constitutional rights are violated. So far in the history of the of this state, we have not had a single case against a school district violating constitutional rights against an administrator. Not one.
Question on the amendment.
Questions on Senator Wasserberger's motion on committee of the whole amendment number one. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay?
No.
Amendment is passed. Division being called for. All in favor of the amendment stand. Opposed, please stand. The amendment is passed. Back on the bill. Further discussion on the bill?
Good bill.
Senator Perkins. Senator Perkins.
Chairman, Mr. Chairman, I'm struggling a little bit. And I guess the problem, one of the problems I'm having is I'm trying to establish a bright line in a world where there aren't any bright lines anymore. So how do you establish a, I'm struggling with this, and I'll give you two things. We just a minute ago passed some legislation that talked about events and created a crime for folks that were potentially never in Wyoming, but they affect a computer system in Wyoming without ever being here. And yet, and the argument we're hearing on this bill, Mr. Chairman, is that, well, that all happened somewhere else. Those bullying happened somewhere else. So this is what I'm struggling with. Because it's digital, is it different? If I pass a note in school that results in bullying or other things, sexual harassment, bullying, anything like that,
if I pass it, they know that we're going to shoot up the gym, or we're going to beat somebody up, we're going to cause physical harm, or we're going to go back and do doobies behind the grandstand, or whatever it is we're going to do. And I write that note down, and I pass it to my friend in school, and the teacher sees that. Unless it's changed, it's in high school, I expect my teacher to come and see that and probably read it. And because I wrote that down, because I wrote it down on a piece of paper, that's not protected. But if I do that same thing digitally, I am protected. I don't understand the difference. And so unless we can get back that, I think it'd be nice if the world was full of bright lines, but my experience, Mr. Chairman, is more and more the world is pretty fuzzy. And I don't know how we create a bright line in these situations. And I understand and I respect the constitutional rights of students. But as been said, the Supreme Court's ruled long ago that, particularly in K-12, universities are a different deal. Colleges are a different deal. But it's called the inculcational model. And because we have that right, we have those students in a confined area, because they're individuals, they're charged with their safety, they're charged with their instruction, they're charged with their food and care, they're charged with now anti-bullying that we did a few years ago, that they have an obligation and an obligation to start this. And now we create this line that says the number one instrument of bullying is no longer passing a note. It's a picture. It's digital. And so we create a dichotomy where an administrator or a teacher is faced, the very instrument that's being used can't be accessed. But yet if you do it by a note, a physically note, you can be. And the fact that it may be done somewhere else, if the effect is felt in the school, I'm struggling with how to differentiate. And unless we can get an answer to that, I don't know that this is a good bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on the bill?
Question.
One concern I have is, Mr. Chairman, is that if, say, the cell phone of my child, my son, is in his car, or say it's at home on my desk, do the school authorities really have the right to make him, you know, go to my house, get the cell phone? I'm just concerned. I understand the presence of a no-no property. I'm just concerned about the idea that my son would refuse to give his phone to a school official, probably even on the campus.
Further discussion on the bill? Discussion on the bill. Senator Office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've already had a robust debate, so I'll just close up quickly and say that it is difficult at this point in time, but we delineate among adults as well. There's clear differences between the legal rights you have for papers at home versus papers you have on your body versus digital information, and it's difficult. So I wish there were a brighter line. The legislation tried to draw one, but this is where we are in a world where we have digital information. The idea, though, that a note handed in the classroom, where the note is fully in the classroom, being handed within the classroom, is the same as something that's never been accessed at the school, is difficult to understand. It may not even be involved. We're not requiring that a student be guilty of anything to have his or her account accessed. We're requiring that the teacher or the administrator thinks there might be something relevant on a social media or private account that has never been accessed at the school, that may have personal information, that may be the equivalent of their personal diary. And we're saying, well, if you think it's important enough, go ahead and access. That's what we can do now. This legislation tries to address that and say, no, it's reasonable for students to be able to protect that private information and to have that diary in the cloud secure for just them, unless their parents or law enforcement is involved, Mr. Chairman. I'd urge the body to support the legislation.
Ready for your question? Question? The question's on the good senator, righteous, prominent, good Senator Coe's motion that Senate file 20 passed committee of the whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay.
No.
Senate file 20 is passed committee of the whole.
Division.
Division being called for. All in favor of Senate file 20 passing committee of the whole, please rise. Opposed, please rise. Senate File 20 has failed to pass Committee of the Whole.
You know, that's not quite fair.
Pursuant to Senate Rule 6-5, having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The Chief Clerk will call the roll.
They can ask for reconsideration.
Agar?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Anselmi Dalton?
Aye.
Baldwin?
Aye.
Barnard? Boner? Bouchard?
Aye.
Burns excused. Case?
Aye.
Christensen?
Coe?
Aye.
Dockstetter excused?
Excused.
Driscoll excused? Ellis?
No.
Emmerich?
No.
Hastert? Excused? Hicks?
No.
Kinski?
No.
Landon?
Excused.
Excused. Meyer?
Aye.
Aye. Moniz?
No.
No. Nethercott?
No.
No. Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
No.
No. Peterson?
No.
No. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
Aye. Von Platern?
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger?
No.
President Bebau?
No.
No. Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 13 aye, 12 no, 5 excused.
Senate File 20 has passed Committee of the Whole. Senator Scott. Senator Scott.
I rise pursuant to the appropriate Senate rule to explain my vote. I voted no on the standing vote and aye on the final vote. And the reason, Mr. Chairman, is that we have the Appropriations Committee off the floor, and on a close vote like this where their votes potentially make a difference, I thought it would be wise to keep the bill alive and carry it forward. And I serve notice now that I intend to object to the bill being read a third time tomorrow on second reading. That would get us a vote with them on the floor.
Thank you, Senator Scott. That clears the desk. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
20? What happened to 20?
That was 20.
That one just did. All right. Thank you.
Oh, we were on so long, it could have been, one more anyway. Thank you. Let's see, where are we? Mr. Chairman, I move the committee whole rise and report.
You've all heard the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Motion carried.
Motion carried.
Yes. You have to pass amended.
Reading clerk will read the committee of the whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under considerations bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 3, do pass, amended. Senate File 8, do pass. Senate File 33, do pass, amended. Senate File 31, do pass. Senate File 30, do pass, amended. Senate File 20, do pass, amended. Senator Hastert, Chairman.
Senator Coe.
For adoption of the committee, the whole report.
You heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That report has been adopted. Okay, where's that? Okay, any reports we need to read in?
Mr. President.
Mr. President.
Senator Coe.
Senate File 35 was read in earlier, and it does have an appropriations request to be re-referred to Committee Number 2.
So noted.
Excuse me. Senate File 35 will be re-referred to Committee Number 2 Appropriations. Virtual Education is the title of Senate File 35.
Anything else that we're going to report?
Standing Committee Reports.
January 11, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number 9, to whom was referred Senate File 7, Bank Service Corporations, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Coe, Perkins, Rothfuss, and Von Flater. Senator Coe, acting chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, I believe that clears the desk.
The announcements, no other announcements? Mr.
No.
Okay. Thanks, thank you. Nobody else was standing up.
You make the motion, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Do I make the motion? Okay. Mr. President, I move that we stand adjourned until 10 o'clock tomorrow, January the 12th.
Now, are there any announcements? Senator Case.
I just lost it, Mr. President. Would you mind going?
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, will meet in Jonah Room S27 at 4:35 to consider the following bills: Senate File 39, Military Department Composition; Senate File 53, Veterans Hiring Preference; Senate File 40, Military Department Record Keeping.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, would like to get involved in this process this session, so we're going to meet tomorrow, half an hour after noon recess, to discuss Senate File 9, Certification of Cases of to State Board of Equalization, and Senate File 10, County Boards of Equalization. That's one half hour after noon recess tomorrow.
Senator Emmert.
Thank you, Mr. President. Please do not confuse me with the Senate Appropriations Chairman. Joint Appropriations will meet Thursday at 8 a.m. Jonah Room L55, Agency Hearings 103, 85, and 68. Joint Appropriations number 2 will meet Thursday upon noon recess, Jonah Room 55, Agency Hearings 53 and 37. Appropriations number 2 will meet Thursday upon adjournment to consider the following bills: Senate File 2, Legislative Appropriations. Mr. President, your Travel Committee number 6 will meet Thursday at 8 a.m., Thursday, January 12th, Jonah Room S27, to consider Senate File 25, Wildlife Location and Research Information Confidentiality; Senate File 26, Game and Fish Licenses Confidentiality; and Senate File 27, State Archives Amendments, if there is time. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator Case.
Mr. President, I've only been here one day, and I've already got the messiest desk in the place. Mr. President, your Corporations Committee number 7 will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in Jonah Room S18. We've got 4 bills listed on the deal, but we're only going to hear 3 of them because Senate File 14, Inoperative Liquor Licenses, was not read in and assigned to the committee today. So we will take up at 8 a.m. Senate File 13, Manufactured Alcoholic Beverages; Senate File 43, Alcoholic Beverage Revisions; Senate File 45, Liquor Dispensing Rooms. Mr. President, with slight leeway, could I mention a reception tonight, or you want me to do that afterwards?
Go ahead, Senator Case.
Mr. President, our friends from the Northern Arapaho Tribe and the Eastern Shoshone Tribe are here tonight. The Northern Arapahos are sponsoring a reception that begins at 6 p.m. at Little America. There's some really good news that's happening as the tribes are working together a little bit better. And at 6:30, there's going to be presentations from both tribes.
Senator Hicks.
President, your Joint Agricultural Committee number 5 will be meeting. Your Senate will be meeting with the House in a joint meeting on Thursday, January 12th, upon adjournment in Jonah Room L54 to review the Department of Agriculture.
Any other announcements? The Senate is adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Thursday, January 12th. Okay, before everyone leaves, I want to have your attention. We're having some issues with the extranet, and Jamie's going to come up and explain a couple things for us. So would you just please hold tight?
Next.